So finger strength is just sort of maxed out, and that's not how you're going to be able to differentiate between athletes. I'm getting patients coming to me saying, oh, well, of course, you know, I can't boulder how I used to because I'm in my 30s now. And I'm like, what? Why? You know, what happens in your 30s? Whereas you're still, you know, really young in your prime. So if you're expecting your period and it's late, that is something that you should give some consideration to. Yeah, there was a definite spike. Nothing interferes with improvement more than injury. You need consistency. So it's fine to step away a little early and finish feeling fresh.
Welcome to another episode of the That's Not Real Climbing podcast. I'm your host, Ginny, and I'm excited to introduce my guest, Andy McVitie. Andy is a climbing PT from Process Physiotherapy. He's been climbing for over 30 years, has coached in the past, and over time has noticed climbing injuries change as the style of climbing has evolved in the competition scene. In this episode, we'll debunk some training and PT myths, talk about the differences between male and female climbers and the types of injuries they face, and we'll hear about why he thinks fingers are strong enough. I hope you enjoy this episode with Andy. Real quick, I'm excited to announce my new sponsor helping make this podcast episode possible, Mad Rock Climbing. I got fitted with their brand new line of high-performance shoes, the D2.1s. They just came out December 6th, but you might notice a few of your favorite GOM climbers are already wearing them, like Oscar Beaudrand from Team Canada, and also me. This is the first time I've gotten to wear their shoes for an extended period of time, and I'm actually super impressed with the grip of their in-house rubber, and of course, the famous drone heel that everyone says is the cheat code to heel hooking small edges. Feel free to message me if you have any questions about the shoes or sizing, and you can use the discount code NOTREALCLIMBER for 10% off your entire Mad Rock order. Info will be in the description. Back to the show. How are you doing today? Excited for the holidays?
Yeah, all set already. Got everybody's presents. Nice. One of those. I think I've had a good year this year for presents. We'll see.
Yeah, presents stress me out, so.
Exactly, yeah. It's just such a relief when you finally see that thing and you just like, that's the thing.
Yeah.
That'll do it.
I can't do like presents under pressure. If I see something in the moment, I want to get it for someone. But then, if there's that deadline, it goes out the window. I can't do it.
Yeah, presents under pressure. I like that. You can feel the stress exuding from that. Yeah.
And then just like nothing good pops out to you.
No, definitely not. And what about yourself? What do you do for the holidays?
Not much really. I mean, I don't really celebrate any holidays just because it's like a lot of effort. And like again, the whole presence under pressure thing,
loving don't have so many plans. People now, I think one of the nice things about the climbing community is that there's a lot of sort of intergenerational sort of mixing that goes on, so I spend a fair bit of time with people that are younger than my children, whatever, that kind of thing, and people are just making such different choices nowadays. It may be a climbing thing as well. Climbing attracts a certain kind of person, doesn't it? But
yeah,
it's just, yeah, people are just like, no, that doesn't make me happy, so I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
It's so refreshing.
I've noticed a lot of climbers just end up going climbing on Christmas or like climbing outside or something like that.
Yeah, but it's even, career choices, that kind of, well, not even career. They're just like, I want a job that's not too harsh, that gives me the income so I can go and climb or do the things that bring me pleasure. And I'm not lying awake in bed at night worrying about work. It's like, wow.
I mean, as someone who's unemployed, that is
okay.
That's what it's like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's how it is.
Okay, so getting into the climbing stuff and I guess the culture and community, how did you get into climbing and then coaching and then eventually becoming a PT?
Yeah, it's been. I suppose when I look back, a little bit of a journey, a bit longer than I thought. Sort of like 31 years of climbing now, I think.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Congrats.
Yeah, but also makes me think, oh, wow, maybe I'm older than I think I am. But I got into it. It was a an activity at school that we did on a school trip where you went away into the countryside and did various things. They have these residentials, they're called, quite common in the UK. We'll go away for a week with the school, and yeah, you do lots of different adventurous kind of activities. Tried climbing, and I can still remember it now. I wouldn't be able to pick the climb or anything. I know which crack and what have you it was. But I can still remember. Yeah, it's totally like, wow, this is the thing for me. But I was quite young then, didn't know anybody else who climbed, didn't really, wasn't able to get into it. And so really it was when I got to university and they had a mountaineering club that it was like, oh, right, there's my way in. It's all there for me. Climbed recreationally, but I was actually, when I left university, I joined the police, was my first career.
Oh, wow. Well, what was your degree, I guess? I guess I kind of assumed that your degree was going to be in physiotherapy, but.
Yeah, but the first one basically was, sports coaching, sports science.
Oh, okay.
So that I've always had that kind of within me. At that time, I was considering joining the armed services, the RAF, and so it didn't matter what degree I did. They just said, pick a degree that you're interested in. So I thought, yeah, cool, sports science, coaching, that sounds good. So I did that, then decided not to join the armed forces, went into the police, and continued to climb through that time. And then had a career change, became an outdoor instructor. And this is back really before coaching was a thing. It was instruction, safety instruction, that kind of thing. Coaching wasn't really around.
You mean in general or just for climbing?
For climbing. Yeah, for climbing. All the other sports were climbing, but still quite resistant to it. It would be like, well, that's not how we do it in climbing. That's, frowned upon. A bit like training. People used to train in secret because you didn't want to admit that you were training to get
better. Oh, really?
It may just be a British thing.
That.
I know. Yeah. People would. Yeah. There's people at school who claim that they never do any revision or homework, but they get marks in all the exams.
Okay, I totally get that.
Yeah. A bit like that. But nobody could admit that they trained. I wanted to give a little bit extra. And Neil Gresham was the first person to start up with an actual coaching qualification. So I went down to London where he was at the time and spent the week there and got some basic coaching input from him. That then I moved to Spain and was working on performance at climbing holidays where people would want to improve their grade. And so they would come on a 1 week, 2 week holiday and get coached basically to improve, and sort of covered everything. And I came back from Spain then. I ended up working in climbing walls while I finally retrained again as a physiotherapist. That's when I did get my physiotherapy degree. And continued there. And that sort of grew, ended up starting a competition squad there and helping run that, and then eventually going off self-employed, myself and my coaching partner at the time, Ellie, formed a competition squad. And now, although physiotherapy is my main part of it, I've been coaching for nearly 16 years. I still have a couple of people that I coach. That's more just interest and fun psych rather than being on the grind of competition coaching.
So you no longer have a competition squad?
No, not anymore. Once the climbing physiotherapy grew, I've been a physio for a while, but only full-time climbing physio for the last 3 years. Because there wasn't that was never going to be a thing a few years ago. You couldn't support yourself. There weren't enough climbers around. And there wasn't the attitude as well that you could, you would go and see a physio for an injury. Again, I think things potentially changed. That used to almost be a badge of honor as to how many injuries you had, but you were still climbing.
Right, yeah. Well, yeah, I guess that still is kind of a thing. But
it is, yeah, interesting. Yeah, so the climbing physios come about. The usual, most physiotherapists who climb will treat friends and help friends, that kind of thing, advise or what have you, and then that just grew.
And so when you started out with like sports science back in the day, did you do like other sports or what interested you in that?
Yeah, so rugby to a reasonably okay level, played for my county. And yeah, we did well at university as well at rugby. We got through to another high level sort of national competitions and running actually I don't do that so much nowadays, but long distance running. I was a sprinter when I was young, but then like ultra sort of mountain marathon.
Oh, really?
Yes, where I ended up with that. That takes quite a lot of time, quite a lot of energy. And I'd come to the conclusion that I couldn't keep us going.
Yeah, I only learned about ultra marathons like probably within the past few months. I like couldn't believe it at first. I didn't know it was a real thing that people could actually do.
Yeah, it's amazing. The human body is just fantastic. When I think actually, having just said all that, of all the different things I've done with my body and that it's adapted to, it wasn't like any of these I was like super gifted at, and neither have I done them to an amazingly high level, but it's like if you give it the time and the space and the correct information to work with, your body will do most things. Absolutely amazing. It's a fantastic bit of kit.
Yeah, so you mentioned that you've been climbing for a long time. You kind of touched on like the evolution you've seen over the years. How does that kind of affect the injuries that you've seen people come in with?
Yeah, so originally treating friends, that type of thing, often like at the crag where, you know, something would happen, somebody would come over holding their finger, come in like that. This has just happened. What do you think this is? It was predominantly fingers. People would worry, I think, about fingers. Fingers would cause them enough anxiety that they wanted to reach out for some help. Whereas if they fell off and badly sprained their ankle, they would just be like, well, that just happens. It'll get better. It'll be okay. Or shoulders, similarly. Elbows, that type of thing. People just certainly used to, still do to an extent, just not seek treatment for it. Just tough up and get on with it. But fingers was always the most commonly, and that's backed up, you know, from research back then, not about people accessing help or treatment, but, you know, which parts of you injured over that, you know, whatever. And yeah, fingers, definitely the majority, I would suggest, of things that you'd see. Now it's everything, which is really nice, because if you just saw fingers all the time, as interesting and as great as it is working with climbers, and every finger injury is a bit different. I think I'd be a little bit bored if it was just fingers all the time.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I guess like specifically in the competition scene, they don't really set like crimpy, fingery stuff too often. I mean, that's definitely part of it, but I don't think the limiting factor is people's like finger strength a lot of the times when it comes to competition climbing. So, do you feel like you see other stuff in the competition space?
Yeah, absolutely. And it has been an interesting and very rapid evolution within the competition space, definitely. And yes, you're right. Athletes this generation have just got to the point where you can't really make a hole small enough for them not to be able to crimp it. You know, they're using bolt holes, aren't they? They're using screw holes. They're using the side of volumes to dig into it with the fingernails and that type of thing. So finger strength is just sort of maxed out, and that's not how you're going to be able to differentiate between athletes. That combined with what became the fantastic sort of visual spectacle of the 2020, 2021 Olympics, the the way to differentiate athletes became about that uncertainty of movement, didn't it? The ability to read a problem, get it right first time, have the movement literacy and the confidence in a competition scenario to be able to go for these low percentage moves and pull them off, as opposed to how hard can you hold? Then you're the big colorful holds, big dynamic moves, all this type of thing that looked spectacular and drew the crowd in. And it worked, didn't it? Because climbing absolutely, exploded after that, and obviously is now included, hopefully long term in the Olympics. But it's that type of movement, much greater peak loads. As if you're jumping to something and actually going for it, hitting it with one hand, whereas often in the past you would still have the other hand on, so there's much more stability through the body. A lot more rotational forces, both sort of intentional and unintentional. So you've got the 360 moves now that everybody likes to see, that kind of thing. But even just, hitting something, when you look at what happens in, Yanya and whatever, in the cobra kick that, she really almost like kicks herself in the back of her own head, doesn't she, when she's doing that? And, the ranges that the body is tested through. A lot more single arm work, which then upsets wrists as well, because you're having control, through the wrist if you've, just a great difference in the movement patterns. There was a narrative review rather than a true research project done in 2021, looking at that and predicting that was Chris Lutter, who's an orthopedic surgeon who works with Volker Schoffel. Don't know if you've ever heard of him. He's has been for ages, super keen climber, German orthopedic surgeon, runs a surgery that specializes in outdoor related incidents, accidents and surgery, and they looked at the movement patterns, the changes, and they predicted actually what we're now seeing 3 or 4 years later, because obviously what is in the Olympics then feeds through into local competition and local setting, in climbing walls, because everybody wants to have a go at that type of thing. And much more shoulders is the biggest change, really. A lot more shoulders. The other one, pushing as well. Never used to push. And now there's all of this going on in some real, positions that when you get your biomechanical head on and you look at what somebody doing, and I'm going oh man, how can you hit yet?
Yeah, some of the push moves are definitely pretty, they're pretty extreme.
Yeah. But this is also, I've chatted with people before about in competition, youth competition, you get some feedback often from slightly unhappy parents of children. But my child got injured on that problem. It was dangerous. Why have you set it? This, that, and the other. Often there will be something underlying why they ended up getting injured on that. They might have had a shoulder injury and that push move then injured them. But I really believe that setters set a challenge. And as long as it's not overtly dangerous, which I've never seen, it's up to the athlete to decide whether they accept that challenge or not. That's part of being, competitive, high level athlete. You have to be aware of yourself. Is that for me? I have to have that discipline, that talk within, for youth, coach, climber, caregiver. Should I be doing this competition? That type of thing. And injuries that come out of competition are it's not the route setters for.
So there's really no move that you've seen set in competition locally or in the IFSC where you're ooh, I really don't want to see that again, or you think it's a little too far?
I Can't bring one to mind. No. And what surprised. I often say is I certainly see things that I think like, wow, you know, how are they able to do that? If I even attempted to do that, that would injure me. But so would playing a game of professional soccer. You know, that would injure me. Yeah, I'm not trained in that way at all. You know, I'm not at that level. What's the injury rate in IFSC competition?
Yeah, I guess I don't know.
Actually,
yeah.
You know, in the competitions itself, good point. Sorry, that's kind of why I'm here, isn't it? Yeah, it's not that high. You know, there is always likely to be a higher injury rate in competition than in practice. But it's not that off the scale. And I can't think of a problem or a route where it's been like, oh, athlete A has been injured. Next one, oh, athlete B has been injured on that problem, you know, that and can't continue, or, you know, is noticeably now limping after doing it or holding their feet, you know, and that being a common theme on a particular problem.
Interesting. Okay. Oh man, I wish I had tried to look through some old comps and see if there was anything that was super dangerous. I guess the thing that comes to mind most recently is maybe like the Salt Lake World Cup, where there was like a jump onto like a Dualtex like slide onto a little chip thing. I feel like I maybe remember an injury or two there.
Right,
also like Natalia was already kind of injured, so my memory's a little foggy.
And that potentially then is the, you know, route setters have got to set for what they, you know, for fully fit athletes. They can't start accounting for, oh, somebody might have this or somebody might have that. And then it's up to the athlete whether they accept that challenge that their setters have set. And sometimes that will feel unfair, because sometimes you will have something that limits you and you might not be able to do that. But that's, again, that's part of being an athlete, isn't it, unfortunately? That you're not going to be 100% all the time.
Okay. Kind of a surprising take to hear from a PT. That's interesting.
I wasn't expecting that. I don't think we're, as a whole, you know, particularly in sports, physio, I don't think we're very, you know, we're trying to help people become robust and strong and to be able to do these amazing things with their body. And if you're like, oh, I don't think you should, or, oh, crap, no, we better be super, they're not going to get there, are they?
Yeah, that's true.
Obviously not if they've just been injured, you know, if they've got an acute new injury, you're not going to say, oh, we're going to ignore that and just crack on. But, you know, rehab is finished when they're able to do those kind of things with no anxiety. That's a huge factor in especially in competitive athletes. You know, there's again a fair bit of research showing that a lot of people who, I'm gonna rough figures here, but about 90% of people following a moderate level injury, you know, something that's taking you out of the sport for a while, about 90% of people will regain all their physical abilities that they had before that. But only about 65% of people actually make it back to the same level that they were before. And that, they believe, is anxiety around that injury recurrence and that type of thing. So it's amazing that the high level athletes do.
Well, I guess they have to.
Which is interesting in itself, isn't it? Yeah, their drive and is that a good thing that they have to? You know, we know from a lot of other sports, don't we, that people are okay, we're just gonna have to give you an injection to get through this game. No, that type of thing. But that's the trade-off of pro athletes.
I mean, yeah, I think that's a really good way to look at it. That like anything can kind of be overcome. Is there any move that you see that really just like kind of scares you? It's just something I really want to know.
I don't think so, no, because they're all so amazingly prepared. Like, for example, when they get thrown these curveballs that happen every so often, like when suddenly cracks started appearing, you know.
Oh gosh, when there was, I don't know if you saw this one, but there was like a kind of jump into like a crack.
Yes, boom. Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah. I've seen that set in local vinyl malls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of thing. You could look at that and think like, wow, that's a bit, yeah. But again, it's there, and it's for people to choose whether they do it or not. Yeah, but they adapted within a handful of months. They'd become like masterful crack climbers. You know, they're just so adaptive and so amazing at what they do. And now with all the incredibly dynamic movements and the timing and the coordination and such like that goes on, I think they can just see, and they also know what their bodies can do. They're quite a lot more aware, I feel, than say your standard climber of, you know, can I do that? No, I'm going to have to adapt it and try, and which is why you see them trying to work around things sometimes, isn't it? Because they almost don't want to do the version of it that they may be kind of getting funneled or forced into doing for whatever reason it might be. And sometimes that's just, yeah, they might feel like I've not got the ability to do that. Yeah, but no, I haven't seen anything that I can think of at the minute that makes me, I'm sure someone somewhere will be able to come up with something, or I'll find something, send me a clip, and I'll send you a video back of me going,
okay, yeah.
But yeah, because, you know, I couldn't, my shoulder, for example, could probably not deal with a lot of the moves and things, you know, the giant leaps and stuff that they do. Yeah, but there's can.
Yeah, I mean, I guess speaking of shoulders, so this is kind of like this is a personal thing for me. My shoulders have just been messed up for like years now.
Right.
Like I can't even really like hang on one arm without pain at this point, okay. Right now.
Yeah.
And I see so many comp climbers landing like one arm dinos where they're just like flying back, hanging on one arm. And I desperately wish I could like rehab myself to get to that point again. They make it look so easy too. Like it's not even like they're putting any strength into it. It just kind of looks like they're
timing,
hanging off of it.
Yeah.
And I just, how do I get to that point where my shoulder isn't messed up so I can do that?
So if we were both to break down what they're doing and also to look at what a kind of a plan might look like for somebody. Yeah, and that's quite common. And that's also an example that people give quite often. They'll say, I can climb, but I can't hang one hand, and I really don't like the thought of going for a dynamic move and having to hit it. So it's something, yeah, they come across quite often. And really for me, why it looks effortless for them is because they're relaxed when they do it. So they're not already full of tension. And you know, this is what I was saying before about the difference with anxiety and why people don't get back to where they were going or where they previously were. Their timing is impeccable. And by that, I mean, as they hit the hold, it's at that dead point. This is where the term comes from, isn't it? Where they're not moving up, they're not moving down. They have that time and space to hold it. So the peak loads aren't shooting up there. Whereas perhaps when myself and yourself grab one of these holes, yeah, we're sort of snatching for it. We've not got it quite so well. And there's a great big shot that comes through. Mm. We don't know how to control our body, like the scorpion kick, cobra kick, whatever you might want to call it, or whatever. That's all about absorbing that energy and then bringing it back in a way that doesn't pull you off the wall. But I probably wouldn't do that. I'd just try and grab on as hard as I could. And my solution to coming off would be to hold on harder rather than relaxing into it. So there's a look at the actual mechanics of what goes on, and that needs to be understood. But then it's finding what the issue is with the shoulder, obviously. And there can be numerous things. It may be structural, you know, there might be a joint issue going on. I could take a stab, and if this is something that's been going on for quite some time, is it your words have messed up for years, yeah, which I would also address the use of the language there and say, come on, it's made, yeah, let's not be too so negative on yourself. I'm sure they're not, you know, that you're still able to do things with them.
Sure,
they're functional. Yeah,
you love yeah. That.
And I find a lot of the time you address that underlying issue. So we might have a rotator cuff injury from a long time ago. And let's say, for argument's sake, that was from trying to do a dyno, and that classic, oh, I've wrenched my shoulder. It didn't really like that kind of thing. There's a lot of muscles that insert into the shoulder, and they all work in wonderful coordination to, you know, to create movement and also to hold the ball and the socket nice and stable in the joint. If through injury, some of that is a bit, a totally non-technical term, out of whack, yeah, that coordination has been affected. Things are not working how they should. So climbing on it is actually causing irritation. The body's great at protecting itself. Yeah, it will dial down the ability of a muscle to output force in order to protect itself. What the body's not so great at doing is bringing that muscle back into full use. The nervous system will kind of check in with the shoulder and go, is it okay? Yeah, okay is good enough. It doesn't know you would really like to do a one-arm dyno. Yeah, it's like, are we under threat? No. Okay, then we're just going to leave the shoulder how it is. And you can correct that through strengthening. You can get your external rotation working, correct the shoulder. What's often missing at the end is that bringing it back into coordination in sport-specific movements and patterns, essentially. And that does two things. One is it tells the nervous system, we need this shoulder to work in this way. Make that happen. Yeah, bring everything back. And it also builds your confidence at the same time. So your movement patterns are natural and relaxed and how they should be, which gives you more headspace with programming and such like rather than worrying about your shoulder. So often what gets missed, even if somebody's strengthened or healed, you know, treated the underlying issue, is that last part of bringing it back into a sport-specific kind of environment, if you like. And that's where this, you know, the further down the rehab you are, the more it should look like training, basically. Yeah, there could be drills, technique drills, strength drills, warm-up, recruitment work to do.
I guess the hard part is kind of like when it comes to these more extreme moves where you're landing on one arm or you're like landing this intense move where you just get a lot of load. It's kind of hard to build up to it. Like it kind of seems like it's 0 or 100 in terms of like if you're going to land it or if you're going to be able to hold it or something like that.
Yeah. And people don't, you might warm up, you might have climbed quite a bit in the session already on climbs of a different character, a different nature to them. And then you suddenly, you know, a few moves into this problem that maybe you've not looked at properly and you're like, oh, wow, okay, big dyno. Or you may have chosen it to go to. Do warm that up. Yeah, you can go to find a bar, fingerboard with big jugs on it, that type of thing. Stand on a chair, drop your feet off the chair in a really nice controlled way. There's a thing I do called foot up catches, which if anybody's listening to this who's worked with me will probably know. And it's a way of gradually shot loading either fingers, wrists, shoulders. So you go under a bar or a fingerboard, pull on it with feet on the floor. If you take roughly, because this is done by feel, half of your body weight through your arms and then pick your feet up off the floor quickly, you've just shock loaded, in effect, your system with 50% of your body weight.
Huh.
That's a nice starting point. And you can progress from there depending on what your level is. I get people doing this, you know, single arm, sometimes single arm on an edge, sometimes on a bar. There's work you can do on a TRX, you know, rings where you're dynamically pulling yourself and catching yourself on the rings as you fall backwards, that type of thing, but done with feet on the floor, leaning backwards, you pick the angle, you pick how big the move is, all done by feel. There's jump and catching a bar that feels nice. Yeah, jump and catch a bar and swing. Jump and catch the bar, swing, then come into a pull-up. Yeah, all this, it's just creating lots of, you know, you've got that, the move started, you know, to coordinate, catch, then swing through, then bring it under control and turn it into a pull, because that's what we do in climbing. So there's That's off the wall. And then there's getting on the wall if you're getting things like, yeah, on spray walls, symmetrical boards, that kind of thing, drills to be. It's a technique. You can't expect to just go, all right, I'm here. That hole's there. I've not really done much of this. Suddenly I'm going to be able to do it like Yanya does it. You know, she does it how she does it because she's done it thousands of times.
Yeah, actually, yeah, that makes sense. I didn't think about warming up in that way, but yeah, I should probably start doing that a little bit more.
Yeah, or even partway through a session. I often see people, so pockets are quite an injury theme at the moment and open-handed work. And people will warm up. They might be pulling on edges, you know, and that kind of thing, warming up, going through. But they've not pulled on pockets, and they'll get halfway through a session. And setters do have a bit of a habit of, it's like they find a pocket in the holes they're working with, and then they go, ooh, and they'll create a line of pockets. I don't know if it's just
the
UK thing.
No, that's true.
Yeah, they do. There's just like a theme, isn't there, suddenly? And it's like, oh, yeah.
It's never just one.
No, it's limited to them. And so you'll go from, yeah, okay, you're quite warmed up, but not for pockets, which is a totally different load coming through the fingers. And then suddenly you're expecting to be pulling quite hard on pockets. Yeah, go find a fingerboard, go do some hanging, you know, three finger, two finger, that kind of thing, warm it up, then go back and crush. Don't just jump on it.
Yeah, and I guess I kind of wanted to touch on something that you had mentioned before we were doing this interview, where you said that you think fingers are strong enough.
Yeah. There is now the ability to measure how hard somebody is pulling on a hold while they're doing a problem. We've got the gadgets now, technology, things that used to cost thousands now cost, you know, hundreds or less. It turned out, I was doing a workshop with some coaches quite a while ago, he'd made something himself, like a good few years ago, to see, and he was actually using it for feet, to see the weighting that was going on within his feet, and it would get a live readback on a little screen. This is like, you know, he's made it himself from some computer bits and all this kind of stuff. Whereas now, yeah, you can get, you know, the force gauges that you can attach into a hole and look at and read. And what we see is that what people are able to, you know, these kind of feats of strength where somebody might be taking the middle bottom rung on the Beastmaker 2000, body weight, lock off, holding other, you know, weights in the hand and that kind of thing. So able to, you know, 70, 80, 90 kilos through one arm and not hitting anywhere near that when we're actually climbing. And so you definitely need to train beyond what you're going to experience in performance. Yeah, because if you've only trained to this level and performance is at this level, your tissues are going to struggle with that and you will get injured.
Of course,
yeah. But yeah, so we definitely need to be a little stronger than we need to be. But as these are still just about the most commonly injured part of our body, then maybe we could afford them a little more space and not hammer them quite so hard and look at other aspects. It's also quite easy for everybody to think, I fell off. What feedback have I got? Well, my hands came off. If my hands were stronger, I would be able to stay on. And so we go down the line of only stronger fingers, as opposed to thinking maybe it was my hip position. Maybe, yeah, I was hanging out at the hips and that pulled me off the wall. Did my foot slip? You know, whatever it might be, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, we just go towards fingers.
I mean, I think people are going to want to know like a number of like, once I hit this, I can stop training my fingers.
Oh my gosh. Right.
No, that's a terrible question, but just in case you have a number in mind.
I don't have a number in mind. So this is like, you know, deadlifting. We know this is beneficial for climbing, great overall body strength, exercise, will get triple extension, all of this kind of stuff that feeds in into your, help to help your climbing. But where do you stop? you know, is a body weight deadlift okay? Do you need 1.5 times? Do you need 2 times? It's all quite individual and relative. I'm not going to be able to say. But and I would suggest for most people, you know, if you can hang body weight off a 20 mil edge on one arm, yeah, you're probably good. And the interesting that then from that, and I say that a 20 mil edge, that won't necessarily relate to you being able to hold a 6 mil edge.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's different. That's recruitment. That's contact strength. That's coordination of the strength to be able to get in on a little edge. So you then train on a bigger edge, but then climb and use small edges to gain the ability to use small edges is a lot more timing and coordination involved on small edges as opposed to just the strength. So yeah, even within that, it always goes, yeah, lots of gray areas, no straight answers. Sorry.
Yeah, there's a lot of nuance. I just know, yeah, I feel like people would want me to ask, so.
Yeah,
gotta,
for sure.
Gotta cover that for sure. So back to the World Cup circuit real quick. I was just thinking about some of the, I guess, like PT things we see on World Cup climbers. I know in like commentary, people have mentioned seeing like KT tape or those like metal stickers that some athletes wear. I still don't really know what those are for. Or just like wearing ice packs all over their body or cupping or stuff like that. Any of those, like, do you have thoughts on any of those things?
I've
if they're helpful or not?
Many thoughts.
Please excuse this brief intermission, but if you're interested in deleted scenes from this episode where he debunks another PT myth concerning push-pull muscle imbalance and what training should look like for comp climbers, do consider helping support this podcast on Patreon. Some other perks include a membership pin shipped to you after 2 months, prioritized guest questions, or the ability to submit video questions, and more to come. The proceeds go back into the podcast to help me break even, and they help me improve the experience of the guests. If you'd like to help out non-monetarily, liking, commenting, and sharing helps a great deal as well. Back to the show.
We have to differentiate in some ways. It's a bit like that when people try and follow the training plan of a World Cup climber. Yeah, it's not going to be suitable for them. And because they're, as well as pushing themselves super hard, probably, you know, to a level beyond what most of us can, they're also after marginal gains. You know, these marginal gains are super important. So they will do things in their training. They will use things to give them an extra 1% because they're already doing all the basics really well. They're getting enough sleep. They're eating a good diet. They are not drinking too much alcohol. They are, you know, they've got that discipline. All those foundational building blocks are there. And so if they've got an injury, they're already doing all the things that I normally try and encourage most people to do, actually. The biggest impact you could have on your injury is not to be using KT tape or an ice pack. It's to make sure you're getting enough calories and protein so your body can rebuild itself. It's to make sure you sleep so your body can rebuild itself. It's to make sure you stay off things that will affect your body's ability to rebuild itself. So K-tape is an interesting one. It provides no support whatsoever to a joint. You can stretch it with you. Yeah, we're talking about how much force, how much pressure that all these athletes are dealing with and these huge peak loads and that kind of thing. A bit of stretchy bandage is not going to hold that shoulder together. Yeah, if their shoulders and ligaments and such like aren't able to. But also, interestingly, neither really does rigid tape. You know, in a PT might run on a sports field and quickly tape somebody's ankle up. And, you know, put about 3 rolls of tape around it and build this almost like cast around the ankle. That provides support for about 20 minutes. And then it also then starts to slacken off because the forces are so huge that are going through the body. What it does, they believe, is it draws the nervous system's attention to that area. Yeah, the nervous system is aware something funky is going on there. Let's give it a little bit more attention. And that's at the subconscious level. Yeah, so essentially more brain computing power is going towards looking after that ankle or shoulder now than it otherwise would have been. And that, they believe, yeah, has a positive effect. Yeah. So it doesn't matter what color it is. It would appear it doesn't matter what pattern it's put on and that type of thing. Is it going to, you know, physically protect that joint? No. Can it have a positive effect that means a re-injury or a worsening of the injury that may otherwise have happened won't? Probably, yeah. And it's pretty, like, there's no or very rare side effects to it. Sometimes some people are allergic to the glue in it, but you know, that's easily tested out. And as long as they don't believe, oh, I can just carry on using my shoulder however I want now, that's, you know, then yeah, you know, no side effects, all good. Ice, as an acute treatment is good. Professional athletes would likely use that slightly differently than we would. They're potentially using that as a way of numbing the signals that their body is trying to give their brain to say, like, hey, maybe you shouldn't be running around on this ankle. But they've got a game to get through, or they've got a competition to get through, and that kind of thing, and they'll deal with it later. That's their decision-making process, not necessarily for us when we actually need to be able to show up for work on Monday, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So different decisions for different people, really, and all these, except for cupping, which I believe from having looked literature, et cetera, can't find anything that says it actually does anything whatsoever. It's just bruising yourself. And I'm not sure why people would.
Okay. Okay.
But there we go. But it does it have a placebo effect? You know, maybe, you know, is that correct to be having that placebo effect? Yeah. As in, is it giving somebody some false confidence that they otherwise shouldn't have? That would be bad. Is it making somebody feel able to do something that they otherwise would have felt, oh no, I don't think I can do this. And if that's appropriate, then that's okay. You know, sports teams and pro athletes will use massage a lot. It doesn't do physiologically as much as most people think. Yes, it can move fluid and blood around a bit and that type of thing, but not hugely. But does it make you feel an awful lot better? Yeah.
It does feel nice, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Is that priceless sometimes?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know, I'm an advocate for it. One of the places where I work, they have a sports masseur there. And I will say, yeah, okay, yeah, go get that, you know. Yeah, go make that feel nice. And yeah, that can be priceless because then somebody feels like, oh, I can use this. I want to use it. This is okay. I was shying away from it before. And so for pro athletes, yeah, that, you know, in sports teams and things, they will have full-time employed masseurs, won't they?
Yeah. You know?
Yeah, because it can make the difference between them feeling like they don't want to play that day to feeling like they can.
And what about the metal stickers? I never got a clear answer, like, listening to the commentary on what it is or, like, what it's supposed to do.
Yeah, I don't know is the honest answer. I have heard and seen and thought, right. I don't know.
Okay. Maybe I got to ask, like, a Japan coach or something.
I have seen from a patient in a previous role I had, it was a neurological physiotherapist for quite some time, and she used to buy these little metal stickers that she would have one on sort of like the nape of her neck at the back there, and I forget where she had the other one, And they would last sort of like 2 or 3 months. And it was some traditional medicine thing from, Asian country. This is all swirling around in the back of my head now. I can't quite exactly remember where. They were quite expensive, but she swore by them and they didn't appear to be having any side effects. Right. I'm going to make a note. Metal stickers. I'm gonna find out.
So yeah, I guess the moral of the story is kind of like, for the average person, just the basics are very important. But then when we're like watching what people are doing on the big screen or like in competitions, and we're kind of seeing them do like it's not necessarily something that you should be doing. They're just doing it because they really need to at that moment.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And if you've got a sore shoulder as well, don't think, oh, they've got a sore shoulder and they're doing that. That's likely the thing that will help me. Yeah, because, as I say, they will have all the basics done. They will have been doing all the basics for years. Yeah, and you're likely still going to climb after work, finishing late, rushing down a hurried meal on your way home. Yeah, getting back home, getting yourself sorted for the next day, not getting enough sleep. Blah, 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 all of that.
Okay, that's a good thing to keep in mind. So that kind of leads me into, I guess, like other PT myths that you have.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Do you want to go into some of those?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I love talking about that. I don't mind talking. You may notice. But education, I think, is like really powerful and really important. And my big one at the moment is about aging. And I'm getting patients coming to me saying, oh, well, of course, you know, I can't boulder how I used to because I'm in my 30s now. And I'm like, what, why, you know, what happens in your 30s? Where is it? You're still, you know, really young in your prime, you know, and now I'm aware, yes, aging happens and it affects everybody differently. So these are generalized statements, but there's quite some information that gets rehashed quite often is this, that you start losing muscle mass from when you're in your 30s. And so you're in a decline, you've peaked, that's it, you're done for. It's all downhill from here. Those are in themselves, they're studies done on the general population, the vast majority of whom don't meet the health recommendations for that, to cardio, strength, this and the other. So already by being active people, we're way ahead of the game. Yeah. And yes, that does start to happen, but it's not a genetic thing or a physiological thing. It's thought now to be a lifestyle thing. So what happens in your 20s, people tend to have more spare time in order to do things that they wish to do, and they often happen to be physical. As you get into your 30s, and again, this is generalized to the general population. There are many people who won't do these things, but this is, as I say, for the general population. They tend to find a partner, have a family of some sort, get a proper job, a career that comes with stress, and that mm-hmm. type of thing, a commute probably, rather than just working in the bar that was just down the street because that's all you needed to do at that time. And all that eats into your time and your energy reserves. And so it's small behavior changes where instead of that, you know, instead of being active 3 times a week, you're now only active 2x a week. That's the difference that starts to happen. And then you get into your 40s and your 50s, and maybe responsibility at work is getting on. Maybe now your children are teenagers and they're taking up quite a lot of your time, shall we say. Then you can get into your 50s. That's how nearly I'm now. And I'm spending quite a bit of time looking after my parents now, which I don't begrudge. That life gets more complicated often the older you get as well. But it's been shown many times as well that you can keep what you've got really quite easily. Yeah, that it isn't an inevitable decline. What I also sort of, and it's not so much about aging, I suppose, but the kind of the story that you said these have been, our shoulders have been annoying me for ages. People will be like, I've got sore knees. Yeah. When I go walking in the mountains, my knees are really sore. So I should not go walking in the mountains anymore. Rather than, like, let's get those legs strong enough and robust enough. And certainly in the UK, that is often, not always, but often a story that people will go and see their doctor and say, it hurts when I do this. And it's almost a kind of a joke response is that, well, stop doing that then, and then it won't hurt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's the solution. So the people's activities and such like get taken away from them, and their, you know, their opportunities to be active. It's not, both from the aging point of view and the rehab point of view, is just, yeah, there's pretty much always a solution. Yeah, that we shouldn't stop things.
Do you feel like that's even the case in the comp scene? Because, I mean, we definitely see, like, these are really high-level athletes. They're definitely very active and probably, well, I guess you can't say that they all have access to, like, a good, like, doctor or PT or something like that. But a lot of them definitely do have access. But they still, I don't know, once they hit around the 30 mark or even like late 20s, they're kind of starting to think about like, oh, I probably can't do this for much longer.
Yeah. And so why do those people, you know, sometimes it's mental burnout. Mm-hmm. Competition, yeah, is stressful. The travel, the time it takes you away from your family, and maybe in your late 20s, 30s or whatever, again, looking at this general population thing, maybe you've got a family now and you're not enjoying being away from them. Whereas when you were young and single, it was super exciting to go travel in the world and that kind of thing. But now you're fed up of the 10th year of just being in a hotel for 48 hours doing the competition and going back home and lots of, yeah, that type of thing. Or yeah, the physical side of things. But it, you know, the what they put themselves through is greatly different to what we put ourselves through. You know, the amount of training, the amount of volume, they are, you know, they truly are pushing their body to the end of its limits. And so, yeah, that can take its toll, both physically and mentally. Then there are the sort of the outliers, aren't they? You know, the people that are competing for years and years. I know one of the sort of the guys who sets in the UK, Dave Barons, I think he was on the World Cup circuit for something silly like 18 years or something like that. You know, there are people that can keep doing it, that absolutely love it, and the body holds up. Every sport has these people that just seem to be good. But then if you look at like who's performing really well outdoors, then there's still lots of people in their 30s and their 40s. You know, Sean is not doing too badly at the moment, is he?
To me, just like observationally, it seems like outdoors, you can kind of keep doing that, I don't know, forever, pretty much. Yeah, you hear like some incredible feats outdoors from like people who are much older.
Yeah.
And that seems to work fine.
Yeah.
And the competition scene, it just doesn't seem as easy to still be like competitive once you're past like a certain age, and more so in like bouldering compared to lead as well.
Yeah, and there can be numerous reasons. Yes, I don't feel actually it's going to be the genetic sort of like, oh, you are now 30. I feel it's more the accumulation of what you've potentially been doing for the last 20 years and the effect that has on the body and the mind and your psyche, your determination. Lots of people, when you hear sports people talk about retiring, and they say, I just knew it was the right time for me to go. You know, I was still performing okay and that kind of thing, but I'm just like, you know, I've not got psyche to do this anymore. And it's really tough. It must be really, really hard, you know, competing, the stress. And I'm sure they love it in equal measure. But, you know, everything that goes on and everything that I have to do. So, yeah. I think who's probably the oldest? Jakob Schubert? Apologies in advance to him if he's not the oldest. And I've just called him out for being old. But because he's not old. But he's maybe old compared to his contemporaries.
Definitely up there. I mean, like Jay and Kim, obviously.
Yeah, still absolutely, you know, but yeah, was absolutely smashing it. Yeah, and just seems to have been around forever. And she, you know, I can remember watching her when things sort of found their way onto the internet, and you could be like watching some grainy footage of a competition from somewhere. Yeah, amazing. But I think maybe we're not, it's only been structured and seen as a career in some ways for a relatively short time, hasn't it? I think there's still really very few professional climbers who earn their money. Do any of them earn their money just from the competition scene?
Likely.
Yeah.
Not.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah. Not a chance, I would have thought. And yeah, the competition, you know, the money's not there and prize money and such like, is it?
Uh-huh.
It's all about, yeah, you know, influence and such like. But it's not being there as a long-term career that people might do. So it would be interesting to see. I think we're going to really have to say, well, maybe let's wait another 5-10 years before we can start seeing what happens to people. What are the patterns that are forming over competitions? What is the average age for, you know, leaving, and the reasons why?
Yeah, true.
And then the true reasons why, because many people when they retire will announce they're retiring for this reason, that reason, or actually there might be a reason behind the scenes for them.
Is there, because I feel like I've heard of it before, but like any research about like power or like speed in particular to aging? Because I feel like you can keep the strength, but maybe like the recruitment is not so fast.
Certainly there's a link to that and aging. There's a fair body of evidence that says that's kind of the first thing to start going. But we also know, you know, and this is how competitors keep going in different sports. And what I expect to start seeing in climbing is, you know, your tactics get better, your mindset gets better. You're able to, if it's a team sport or what have you, or even in individual, but you're able to read the game better and be where you need to be before the other players have figured out what's going on. So although you might not be as fast, you're still in the right places at the right times.
Uh-huh.
Now for something like climbing, yeah, and as you say, particularly bouldering, I think that's a really interesting question. I know we hold on to what we have a lot better than people think. You know, again, going back to what I was saying about aging and such like, it's not just this that will happen at this age. Yeah, I don't know of any actual studies relating that to, because most of the power type sports and that type of thing that we think of and the research within that will also be lower limb based.
Okay.
Yeah, which can be quite different. That's another one I'm going to make a note of.
Come back with any information and I'll put it in the description and people can follow up on that. Do you want to go into, I know you had mentioned a couple of other myths. I also know that I just want to like keep an eye on the time.
I guess if we're going to look at one other myth, it would be that injury that happened to you that night was caused that night. And there's been some good recent research now coming into climbing's good quality. There's a lot that's not great quality, but some really good stuff. And it's a bit of a shame because we've got, as a relatively new sport that's getting new research into it, we've got the opportunity to learn from all of the mistakes that other sports have made. And not necessarily mistakes, but just almost like admin errors where they don't define a variable, you know, accurately. So anybody else who's doing some research in that area, you can compare the results. And it'd be nice to think we'd do that, but we're not doing. So we're getting lots of research that might all be in the same area, but when you try and compare them, you can't. It's apples and pears, basically. You can't do these comparisons. But where we do have some really good research is into the fact that, and this staggered me, is that up to 94% of injuries in climbing are chronic injuries, not acute. Yeah, so that overuse, overload, under recovery, whatever else right. you might want to think of it as. So pulley injuries being the most common, that people think, I was trying that problem, I didn't warm up properly, I tried it too many times that night, it was that move. Actually, unless there was a whole break, foot pop, and an opening of the hand under unexpected shock load, the pulleys should be able to deal with us pulling on them as hard as we can. If the pulley's in good order, it should be able to deal with pretty much whatever we throw at it. There is often, when you look back and talk to somebody about sort of the 6 to 8 weeks previously, they'll be like, oh yeah, I have been pushing it hard. I've been training, got trip coming up, got this project, whatever. Yeah, that they'll have stepped something up, or vice versa. Yeah, I've kept my training and everything the same, but life's got really busy at work, big project on at work, or got some family stress going on at the moment and that kind of thing. And yeah, up to 94% of injuries in climbing are overuse based, including a lot of the ones that we think aren't. And it really is about just keeping an eye. I encourage people I work with to have a weekly check-in with themselves. I don't mean like have a word with yourself, sort yourself out, but like just a quick like top to toe. Yeah, it might be a good idea. A quick top to toe is like, how am I feeling? Is that, all right, you're a bit of a niggle in my left ear. Pop that in your training diary, make a note in your phone or something. And next week when you have your check it, that's still there. Okay. Yeah. Third week. It's still there. This is not I need to give this some attention. Yeah. Because what often happens with injuries is, with the benefit of hindsight, people will go, oh, that's what it was. Yeah. I saw that. I did have a little bit of, I remember last week, it was just a bit sore after I was climbing. And a lot of the time, injuries don't shout that they're coming. They don't send you a letter. They don't say, I will be arriving on Monday. They don't shout at you to say, this is going to happen. It's a whisper. It's a very small whisper. And we miss the signs because of that. It's really easy to. So just this little check-in every week, this 5 minutes of just what bits are a bit sore, and bits do get sore, but if it's only sore for a week and then it goes, that happens, doesn't it? We get niggles. But if it's hanging around for a while, then it's like it's being an injury and it needs booking up.
Well, thank you for sharing those myths. Hopefully we can spread the word. But yeah, you mentioned that you want to go into some of like the current research out there between like male and female climbers. I'm definitely really interested in that as well. So yeah, what are some of the issues that they did research on?
Yeah, and this is one of the areas where, although I said before that in some ways climbing isn't doing itself any favors in the research world because everybody's researching it, but we're all doing it separately and it's not comparable. But there are some people, one I'm fortunate enough to know and call a friend, Gudmund Grunhaug, who's from Norway. And he's a full-time researcher in climber. Absolutely fantastic that we've got that, people like that on looking into it. He does a lot of qualitative research, or a lot of kind of like questionnaires to people, that type of thing, asking about injury and this, that, and the other. And then within that, he's able to differentiate. He's able to get the message out there and to get comparisons between male and female, or just do female-specific research. And I'm aware that the terms are a little interchangeable, men, women, female, male, that type of thing, which can be quite rightly a sensitive issue. Now, my sort of rule for this is I use the language that's been decided on within the research paper. They have decided how they're going to categorize people within that, and within research, again, I stick with that. Two really, really good papers that he's done. One in particular was called Painfully Ignorant. And it was a female only, and looking at elite IFSC competitors, asking them about their injury history, how often they get injured. And then there was almost an incidental question within it around eating. And I've made a couple of notes to make sure I get the numbers right. 32% of those questions, I think there was a couple of hundred who answered the questionnaire, felt that they had disordered eating of some sort. And
that's a lot.
And that's people who are prepared to admit it, although it was an anonymous questionnaire.
Yeah, true.
And people who are aware enough themselves that they have that, that aren't in denial, that aren't even aware that what they're doing is, it might be some form of disordered eating. And that doubled the people who, within disordered eating. It doubled your chance of injury. Yeah, if that makes sense. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's one of those statistical things within research. It's not actually that hugely significant. It's like saying something is doubled, but it's gone from 1 to 2.
Sure, yeah.
Is not huge numbers-wise and that kind of thing. So it's not necessarily, a huge correlation there. But I thought, really, really interesting. So that one I was just talking about the IFSC climbers was called Top of the Podium at What Cost? And the second one is Painfully Ignorant. And that was looking at the impact of gender and training on injury in climbing, looking at the fact that we all climb the same routes. And are there any significant differences between injury rates, injury types, between the genders? And again, that showed shoulders a different population. So this wasn't IFSC climbers again. Yeah, this was like general climbers. But again, shoulders came out top for women, whereas for men it was still significantly fingers.
Top, do you mean like just in terms of injury rates or?
Yes, precisely that. Yeah. So for women, shoulders, 35% of them reported a shoulder injury. And for men, it was 21%. So a big difference there. Whereas for men, fingers, it's 43%. And for women, it's 33%. So the shoulders and fingers at 35% for shoulders and 33% for fingers, very close. But it's the first time we've seen this, all previous research has just been fingers, 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 right, fingers. Okay. And then just suddenly, since this is 2024, this paper, since this change in setting that we were talking about earlier, we're now getting shoulders and an increase in knees, ankles, that type of thing as well, from falling more. It comes back to, what we were saying before, really, about movement, different movement patterns, rotational forces, higher peak loads, bigger moves, jumps, more one-arm stuff, that kind of thing. And although setters, there are female problems and roots, male problems and roots, in general training, everybody climbs the same stuff. So these IFSC climbers, when they go to Innsbruck to train, it's not, these are the women's routes, these are the men's routes. And then that feeds in, not only has there been this change, and as we know, generally speaking, men have more muscle mass, more of that upper top, whereas it's the other way around, generally speaking, for females. So potentially their shoulders could be a little bit more susceptible anyway, just genetically. But when you're training on generic routes that everybody and the vast majority of setters are men.
Uh-huh.
And so there will be likely a slight reach. You are more likely to be shorter as a female. You're more likely to be taller as a mate. They're not, nobody's doing it on purpose, but maybe more thought might need to be given. Have you ever followed or seen Kimbrough clans?
I have. Not too familiar though. So
right. He's the philosophy professor who's also like super keen climber. guidebook writer, that kind of thing, real climbing activist. But I think he's also quite tall. But his whole thing is about personal greats. Is that you cannot for a minute say that, like, you know, some boulder problem that's famous for having a great big span on it is going to be the same grade for somebody who's 5 foot tall than it is for somebody who's 6 foot tall. And so why are we, you know, a slight digression for what we're talking about here in comp climbing, but it's really interesting. Really interesting way of looking at things. Interestingly though, in both of those studies, females were not getting injured more than men.
Just differently.
And it didn't appear to be of a greater severity either.
Based on those results, like, what do you take away from that? Like, what do you think is the learning there?
As I sort of suggested, and it is only a suggestion, perhaps the generalized genetic makeup, female versus male, might make females more susceptible to this type of thing with the modern style of setting. Is the modern style of setting going to change? There's no sign of that happening. So people are going to have to adapt. And so more strength and conditioning work for the shoulders. But we also know, well, I was going to say probably not at the elite level, but maybe the facilities are often not there for female athletes. The spaces where you go to strengthen and condition and train and that kind of thing are not very welcome often for female athletes and that type of thing. So there's historical barriers there, and that might be what we're seeing now. So in football, for example, they feel that in soccer, a lot of the knee injuries that are happening to the professional women's soccer players, like loads of them, you know, there's absolutely loads of them. And there's various things they're looking at, one of which is, as they were growing, they didn't have access to strength and conditioning. So whereas the boys at the end of a training session might be encouraged or would go off to the gym and do some strength work and that kind of thing, it wasn't when these now women were girls, like 15 years ago, society just wasn't thinking, oh, we need to get them in the gym. So as the boys grew into men and went through puberty whilst doing weights, they grew that kind of a body. Their body responded to that, and they missed out on that. And one level below the women's soccer elite, they've got the nutrition advice, they've got the weight training, they've got the strength and conditioning experts, they've got all that. You go a level below that, because the money's not really in the game, it's there in the top level, not below. They don't have the strength and conditioning. They don't. So when these players come up through the ranks, they don't get that kind of input until the very top. And it'd be interesting. I think that there's facilities now, but there are societal and, you know, norms, expectations, behaviors that aren't that encouraging for women to get into strength and conditioning.
Good to keep in mind. I also definitely wanted to touch on this. This was like one of the Discord questions that had come in as well. Have you like seen any research out there about how a female athlete's menstrual cycle affects their strength and injury rate?
It's going to be another gray area. It depends. Okay, yeah. Answer from me. What we do have, and I'll happily provide a fair few sort of like links to what I feel that are good quality resources on this that are also easy to follow. So it's people are out there doing the research, some super professional, amazing researchers who are also putting it into practice, but then putting it out on Insta. So it's nice, easy. Yeah, it's not going to be sending people dense research papers and that type of thing. And the answer does seem to be, it depends. You can't foresee that your cycle will definitely do this. It may change from month to month in how it affects you. The length of cycle, etc., may change from month to month, so you may not be able to plan. It's all so irregular. that it's incredibly hard to kind of figure out. But you certainly can't say as a population, this is what will happen to you through your cycle. It's incredibly individual. Same as when it comes to menopause and postmenopause, perimenopause, hugely individual experience. And so it's about tracking for you. So yeah, track your cycle. There's apps out there. Sequence is a climbing training app that I like. I have no affiliation with them at the moment. But within that, they're the first one I've seen. It's actually built in a menstrual cycle tracker into a climbing training app. Yeah, I think it's great, especially as it's run by two guys. I hope they don't mind me saying, computer nerd guys. So brilliant that this message is getting out there enough that people are thinking this is needed. And so to see if there is a general pattern that follows for you, and yes, then there is some basis of thinking that you may feel less confidence at certain points. You may be better off doing some training, some strength training at a certain point, or some physical and some aerobic, fitness training at some point. Or you might need more carbs at a certain point, this type of thing. But it's not written in stone. And I say to people, imagine if you know that every Friday is a really busy day at work. Yeah, and you could never be bothered going climbing after all. You finish too late to go climbing, for example. But if you don't have your stuff in your car for after work, yeah, who knows? Like every so often, a Friday might not be busy. And then you just miss out, don't you, if you've not prepared for the fact that it might not be. And so it's more about checking in with how you are at that time on that day. And responding to that and not feeling bad about doing that, if that makes sense. That if you've got to change your plans around something or whatever, that's fine. That's what your body's telling you. If that's what your body needs to do that day, then that's what needs to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in terms of like the injury risk, was there like a certain time?
So yeah, that's still muddy, partly because a lot of the research hasn't been of great quality, and there isn't a great deal of it. It's coming through now. One of the best ones I've seen was done by the Women's FA, the soccer, the football association in the UK, where they looked at from youth football all the way through to the Women's Premier League, many, many hundreds of female footballers. And tracked, blah, 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 this, that, and the other, and looked at the injury rates. There wasn't really a hugely clear pattern, apart from when they were late for their period. So if you're expecting your period and it's late, that is definitely, well, that's a big word to use in research, that is something that you should give some consideration to. There was a definite spike, at that point, more than anything else. And that was the one thing that really came out of that. This idea, I know people like Lattice, that they're sort of like messaging when this first started becoming like, oh gosh, we need to look at this. This is a thing. How come we have overlooked this? 51% of the population's female. A lot of women climb. What are we doing? And so the big messages that were coming out was almost like, you will feel this in week one, you will feel this in week two, you will feel this in week three. And as we've learned more and they've learned, their messaging now is, and they've had some good output, and it's on, their websites and their social media. You can go and have a look, and it will be like, this may be what's going to happen, or this might be how you feel, or it's likely that you may feel like this at this time. Yeah. And that kind of thing. But that, again, their advice is track, find out what happens for you, because not everybody's different. And then don't plan for, but don't expect that to happen every month.
Yeah. I think that's a pretty pivotal part of it. But with like, those watches that kind of track, your vitals and stuff like that, or like if it tracks your sleep. I think sometimes it will tell you that you slept poorly. And so then you kind of go about your day.
Yeah.
I just had to stop doing that because I was like, okay, maybe I did sleep poorly, but like then it telling me that I slept poorly just makes me feel even worse. So it's not really helping.
And there's you're absolutely. And that's definitely seems to be a thing, doesn't it? We get told this objective information and we're like, oh, right. Okay. Yeah. So therefore this is how I'm going to be today.
Mm-hmm.
But the information side of things can be fantastic. There's also some research I found as an aside, once looking at, so athletes who were really well educated and knew that they needed, you know, a certain duvet or a certain room temperature and a certain mattress type in order to get their best night's sleep in order to perform up. And these are those marginal gains that, you know, these teams and athletes and stuff go for. What happens if they don't get that because they're in a competition in, yeah, some country they've never been to and they've not been able to arrange that? And the teams that don't either know that or don't have the ability to have that, so they just get in on doing it, they don't mind. But these other teams can fall to pieces because they've not got all of these things that they feel they need or that should happen. And without that, then I'm not going to be able to do this. And there's an awful lot of auto-regulation of checking in with yourself, you know, and it's hard though. It's a learned, you've got to learn to do it.
Yeah, I was just thinking because also part of the question they mentioned when Yanya said that she had won most of her medals while on her period. So it's kind of like, I guess sometimes you just need to ignore it and maybe it'll be fine.
Well, what choice did she have?
Yeah, that's true.
If that's when it's scheduled. But going back to, you know, what we were saying before, like sometimes, yes, the setting is going to be unfair for somebody at some point because they've got an injury or something happening. They can't schedule competitions around all the individual athletes' periods, can they? And so it's, I suppose when you look at it, all within all those competitors that come out at an IFSC, a few of them have got to be on a period at that point, haven't they? I once gave a talk basically on the menstrual cycle and the menopause, which was obviously attended by women and no other men. And I started by saying, you know, the irony is not lost on me that I'm a middle-aged, middle-class white man who's going to stand here in front of a room of women and tell them what their experience should be. So, you know, I am purely talking from the research and the papers and that kind of book. It's kind of nice that the overwhelming, what seems to be coming from that now is, yes, we have this information, but that's not your destiny.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Okay. Well, I guess we can just go into the Discord questions then. I think that was a good place to end things off there. There were still so many other things I wanted to ask, but, you know, maybe another time in the future, But yeah, going into a couple of Discord questions. The first one, most people seem to talk about PIP injuries. Do you have any advice for dealing with DIP issues, I guess DIP issues, in particular synovitis or capsulitis?
Right. Okay. Yeah. The first, I suppose, for whether it be DIP, PIP, but if we talk synovitis, capsulitis, it's a little bit semantics as to, you know, which is it, that kind of thing. It's an overuse of that joint in a certain way. You are not going to win unless you give it some space. And it is a process that is going on. It's like a negative cycle, I suppose, really, of irritation, sensitivity. The body's response to that actually sets it up for being more easily set off the next time with this inflammatory process that's going on with it within the finger. Obviously usually crimping and such like is the thing that does it. This is one that it's all the interventions in the world of penguin fingers or, you know, this, that, and the other, which has its place. It's a good thing. Isn't going to do it. It is the basics. It is, you know, listening, finding what it's able to do, because I'm a big believer in, you know, let's kind of keep climbing. I sometimes, how some people are aware of themselves enough to monitor their own crimping, you know, and reduce that and start climbing open-handed. I find if somebody's quite new to climbing, and we go to crimp for a reason, is it is stable. It's not necessarily the strongest hold, but it's stable. You can move around a crimp. Yeah, and we're on it, and we feel like we're not going to slip off it. Whereas like open hand stuff and slopers, and so asking somebody to go open handed if they've not got a great deal of movement experience in climbing can feel just like starting all over again, and it can be really hard for them to manage. So sometimes I actually just call it anti crimp taping. I had to say, get some cheap tape, wind it down the finger, wind it back up the finger again, or most likely the middle finger it'll be. Yeah, literally to stop you from being able to bend the finger because of the bulk of the tape. It doesn't provide any support. It doesn't do anything magic. Yeah, it just stops you. In an open position, the forces on the finger are distracted. Yeah, it's trying to put, it's when we come up into 90 degrees most often for this type of issue. Yeah, and the bones then are pushing against each other, it becomes compressive, and it's those compressive forces normally from crimping that set it off. So you can continue to climb, but you just got to really back off.
That's hard to hear.
It is. But there's loads that you can do. Look at all the open-handed climbing that there is now. This is what we're talking about, the change in style. It's not all about crimping. And it's a bit like the picture I use with people. It's that oil tanker that you put the brakes on, and it takes a long time to stop. Then you've got to put it in reverse, and it takes a while to get going for reverse. And then it comes out. Yeah, it's quite a slow process. But with the right approach to it, you are able to keep people climbing, keep people in climbing, which I think is super important, because for most of us, climbing becomes, won't quite say everything, but it becomes super important in our lives, doesn't it? It's your social interaction. It's your escape, maybe from family stress, work stress, when you could either go and be sociable and chat to everyone, or you can put your headphones on and just have some lovely time to yourself, that kind of thing. It's engaging, it's physical challenge, it's a mental challenge, it's people's mental health space. So the last thing I say to people is stop climbing.
Yeah, like personally, I had it really bad a year or two ago, because I was like climbing at a gym that set just like crimps all the time, and like everything was always crimpy.
Sounds great. And, I want to go.
Yeah. It wasn't super interesting, but I'm like doing a little bit less crimping now, more just like, open-handed stuff. It's not always crimps, and it's improved a lot.
There's active, you know, things that we can do. It isn't just about taking away. There's strengthening the rest of the chain, shoulder, elbow, wrist, that kind of thing, working on the muscles within the hand that formed like the control and foundation for the fingers, that type of thing. So it's not just a passive treatment.
Well, I also have these things. It's kind of like penguin fingers, but you can like put in the microwave.
Ooh,
and
cool.
I love heat on my fingers. Like if my fingers are cold, it hurts so bad.
Right. And interestingly, you know, there's as many research papers saying that heat is better than ice as there is the other way around. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the they've both been heavily researched, there's just as many landing on one side than the other, neither with big margins. It's like, we think heat is a bit better than cold. Kind of draws you to the conclusion of that they're both as good as each other. They both end up in the same place just through different mechanisms. They provide pain relief through the novel stimulus that they give to the nervous system. Similar to, you know, when you rub something that's sore, and it can kind of stop it hurting a little bit. It's that kind of effect. They both do that. And they both encourage fluid exchange, you know, which is good for healing. Both through different methods. And so it's very much kind of personality led. Some people really want to stick an ice pack on it and feel like they're hammering it down and they're beating it into submission. And they're, yeah, that kind of thing. I'm with you. I'd like a nice hot water bottle. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Yeah, it feels nice. Okay. Yeah, let's just do one last Discord question. This one is from Erica. She asks, how should an experienced climber start integrating more training into their routine? For me, it can feel overwhelming and directionless because there's so many options and I don't know what's best or most needed to improve my climbing. And so I guess doing it in like a safe way and preventing injury.
Right. Okay. Yeah, because that costs you, where are you trying, what are your goals? Where are you trying to improve? What are your weaknesses? That type of thing. But yeah, you are at your starting point, if that makes sense. If you are at a load that you are happy with and your body is dealing with, then you can start increasing that load. And you're much better off doing that in a way that is going to be consistent for you with it. As we're recording this, obviously it's coming towards the end of 2024, New Year's resolutions. Everybody goes, wow, I'm going to train 8 times a day. I'm going to do this, that, and the other. Yeah. And 2 weeks later, the wheels have come off and we're not managing it. And we get peaks and troughs, and peaks and troughs are not good. Yeah. Not doing very much. And then you've got trip coming up and going mad at it for 2 weeks. Not good. What we need is slow, gradual improvement. Small steps that over the course of a year add up to quite a big change. It's something like, I think, with kind of compound interest, if you improved something by 1% a week, which is not a lot, by the end of the year it adds up to something like 60 or 70%.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could improve, and it doesn't kind of work in this linear fashion, but if you could improve your climbing by 70% in a year, that's amazing, isn't it? And you've only got to improve things by 1% a week in order to do that. So gains do not come quickly. They are hard won, but that's fine. Yeah, if we take this small step approach and track what you do, it doesn't have to be a hugely detailed training diary. One that I quite like for people that are just starting is to write how long the session was, say 2 hours at the climbing gym, and how hard they tried, say 8 out of 10. It also starts getting you thinking about how hard you're trying. If every session you go to says 8 out of 10, 8 out of 10, 8 out of 10, 8 out of 10, there's something going wrong with your training. Yeah, you need some variety. Okay, yeah. So you times 2 hours by the 8 out of 10, you've got 16 punts. This is not my system that I came up with. It's been around for a while. It's arbitrary units. Yeah, they don't mean anything. It's just 16 load points, if you want to look at it like that. And then add that up over the week. So if you do 3 of those sessions, you've got 48 load points in a week. Yeah. So what you don't want to do next week is increase that to 70 load points.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You want to make that up to maybe 53, 55 load points, just a small little increase. These rules are often around 10% a week, that kind of thing. Not too bad. But if you went 10% a week every week for the next year, that would end up being, when you start, you can maybe take some bigger steps. But you're always better under training by 10% than over training by 1%. Yeah, so it's small steps. Track what you're doing in some way, that works for you. Some people love a spreadsheet and love numbers and that kind of thing. That totally does my head in. I can't do that. I'm much more of the write down in a notebook. That type of thing. Don't overthink it too much. Don't be like, well, it was a 2-hour session, but actually I was only climbing for half of that because I was resting for the other half and that kind of, don't overcomplicate. It matters too much. And if you have had a big long route session and actually you did spend, you met some friends, had a coffee halfway through, met some other friends, went for some cake, that kind of thing, then maybe change it. But if it's just a normal session, then just keep it as it is. Don't overthink it, but track what you're doing and increase things by less than you probably think.
Great advice. So any New Year's resolutions for you?
But do you know what? I'd actually said this to someone earlier today. I'm stepping away from the whole New Year's resolutions. the time to start making changes is now, not some arbitrary date in the future and that kind of thing. You don't get any extra motivation because it's January the 1st. But it's actually to make sure I undertrain this year rather than overtrain. Physios and coaches need physios and coaches because we are human and we do the things that we tell everybody else not to do. And this year I went hard at it trying to perform 3 times a week, despite talking with my partner at the start and saying, we've got the chance to go climbing outdoors 3 times a week. We mustn't try and redpoint 3 times a week. That would be a really silly thing to do. And within 2 months, we were redpointing 3 times a week, absolutely loving it, having some successes, ticking lots of things. It's all going well. And then it all didn't go well.
Injury or?
And camp burnout, basically. Yeah, okay. Just like, I am absolutely knackered. It took me a while to figure out what was going on. So thankfully, no, not injury. And so this year I'm going to undertrain by 10%, not overtrain by 1%.
Take your own advice. Okay,
yeah, it'd be awesome. Good, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think that's all the questions I had. Thank you so much for joining me.
No problem.
Any last words that you want to get out there?
Oh, I don't know. It is just, if you want to improve at climbing, then injury is the one thing that is guaranteed to stop that improvement. Yeah. Nothing interferes with improvement more than injury. You need consistency. So it's fine to step away a little early and finish feeling fresh.
Perfect. Want to let people know where they can find you?
It's processphysiotherapy, or one word, .co.uk is my website. And I'm on Instagram at process.physio. Are the two main places that you'll find me.
Perfect. Yeah, I'll leave those links below.
Lovely. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. It was amazing to talk to you.
Yeah, no problem. No problem at all. Thanks.
Thank you so much for making it to the end of the podcast. Don't forget to like and subscribe if you enjoyed. Otherwise, you are a super big climber. If you're listening on a podcasting platform, I'd appreciate if you rate it 5 stars, and you can continue the discussion on the free competition climbing Discord linked in the description. Thanks again for listening.